This is Free Speech Radio News, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on the program, Republicans picked up a congressional majority in elections this week. We'll look at what that might mean for the economy, immigration, and the environment. Voters in four red states passed minimum wage hikes. And is the fracking boom a financial bubble that's about to burst? Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. Voters sent a mixed message in midterm elections this week, supporting local ballot initiatives traditionally aligned with Democrats, while heavily electing Republican candidates to both state and national office. In Hawaii, local farmers and residents in Maui County passed a temporary moratorium on genetically modified crops, despite massive outspending during the campaign by biotech seed giants Monsanto and Dow AgroSciences. And while voters did defeat initiatives to require labels for food containing lab-modified genes in two states, in Oregon, the margin was just a single percentage point. Voters legalized marijuana, approving recreational use in Alaska, Oregon, and in the District of Columbia. A ballot measure to legalize medical marijuana failed in Florida, though the margin was slim. In California, Proposition 47, a measure to roll back the state's three-strike sentencing laws, passed by a 7% margin. And candidates for city council in Richmond, California, handily defeated pro-Chevron rivals in a town where the oil giant owns a refinery. Nebraska, South Dakota, Alaska, and Alabama all voted in favor of raising the minimum wage. Those same states sent Republicans to the Senate. According to Pete Davis, activist with the Time for a Raise campaign, Democrats made a mistake by not campaigning in favor of an issue with widespread voter support.
We've been pushing hard to get Democrats to be proud of this issue. It's an insanely popular issue. You don't get many issues polling above 70%. And it polls above 50% among Republicans. So half of these Republican voters even want a minimum wage raise too, and they ran away from it. So take example Mark Pryor, who lost in Arkansas. He was the only Democrat that came out against raising the minimum wage because he thought it would hurt him in his reelection. But by the end of the election, both he and his opponent had to come out in favor of it because it was so popular. So, if think of all these non-voters that didn't turn out that are among the tens of millions of Americans that are making less today than any worker made in 1968 because the minimum wage was so much higher back then adjusted for inflation.
As the dust settles from Tuesday's Republican takeover of Congress, thoughts on how the 114th will handle some of the country's most pressing issues are beginning to form. But as Ashley Westerman reports from Washington, D.C., analysts say Congress is going to have to find some agreement on how to handle the more hot-button issues.
From the vantage point of Capitol Hill, there was almost no stopping the Republican Party on Election Day.
On a night like tonight, you're grateful above all else. And for me, that gratitude starts with the people of Kentucky.
Thank you. Oh, my goodness. Thank you, Iowa.
As Republicans in Colorado, we've gotten used to the saying, wait until the next election. Well, I've got news for you. That next election, it finally happened.
That was Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, Senator-elect Joni Ernst of Iowa, and Senator-elect Cory Gardner of Colorado giving their victory speeches, all Republicans with important wins Tuesday that helped their party solidify a majority in Congress. In an election seen as a referendum on President Barack Obama's administration, not only did Republicans gain a majority in the Senate by flipping at least seven seats, they also managed to expand their presence in the House by winning at least nine additional spots. But a Republican majority for the 114th Congress doesn't necessarily mean the party will be able to easily push through their policy priorities. Analysts say Congress will still have to come to some sort of an initial compromise on how to deal with hot-button issues before any work can be done. Take the economy, for example, which Gallup has identified as voters' number one issue this election. Peter Morici, an economist with the University of Maryland, says Obama and Democrats have a very different opinion than Republicans on how to create jobs.
You don't create jobs by just spending federal money because somebody's got to pay for it sooner or later. And so we're going to have to generate them through the private sector. Unfortunately, we have a Democratic Party which holds the White House. It doesn't believe in the private sector at all.
Morici takes the long-held conservative position that lowering corporate taxes and relaxing economic regulation will help stimulate job creation. Other economists point to the ever-widening disparity between the wealthiest Americans and everyone else as reason to question the logic behind so-called trickle-down economics. Immigration is another issue that often rises in economic policy discussions. Immigration policy analysts say Congress can at least agree that something needs to happen with the estimated 12 million immigrants in the U.S. without authorization.
But why it's a problem and what should be done about it, that's where kind of agreement ends.
That's Steve Camerota, director of research at the Center for Immigration Studies, a think tank that lobbied against a bipartisan immigration reform bill in 2013. Camerota predicts continued stalemate on the issue.
Some bills will be introduced, people will talk, but not much is going to change in Congress because anything in particular this Congress would pass, President Obama would be very unlikely to sign.
Obama has told Congress he is willing to issue an executive order if legislators continue to stall on immigration reform. But Camerota says such a move could spur a constitutionality fight and further polarize the issue. Another question in the air is how the Republican majority Congress will act on environmental issues. Keith Gabey of the Environmental Defense Fund says addressing climate change should be at the top of the congressional priority list.
It's the greatest threat to our economy. It's the greatest threat to our future. And Congress needs to take action on it. They have failed in the past. But eventually they're going to have to deal with it.
Gabey says while Obama's previous actions to curb carbon pollution from power plants and greenhouse gases from cars are steps in the right direction, Congress will eventually have to come up with some sort of comprehensive clean energy plan.
If Congress has new ideas about how to solve environmental problems, that's great. If their goal is to undo environmental protections, I think they're going to quickly realize that they're out of touch with the American people.
With all this talk of the newly elected Congress, don't forget the current Congress still has a few remaining weeks in its lame duck session. But when they return to Washington next week, neither the economy, the environment, nor immigration policy are expected to be on the table. Instead, analysts say Congress will focus on passing a budget. The current continuing resolution to fund the government expires December 11th, as well as once again pick up the issue of what to do about the Islamist militants known as ISIS. The 113th Congress will end its term on January 3rd, and the new Congress will be sworn in the very same day. Ashley Westerman, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
In local elections, voters in Denton, Texas, Athens, Ohio, and San Benito County, California, passed bans on the drilling technique known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. Denton is sometimes called the birthplace of fracking, and its ban is already facing legal challenges from the Texas Oil and Gas Association, an industry lobbying group, as well as the Texas General Land Office, the state agency that administers drilling leases. The practice of hydraulic fracturing to extract oil and gas from shale formations is both lucrative and controversial. Energy companies say fracking technologies have allowed the U.S. to gain greater energy independence and become a top exporter of natural gas. Environmentalists charge the practice will have profoundly negative consequences on clean air and water for generations to come. In the more immediate future, some financial analysts are warning that the fracking boom is a bubble that's about to pop. For more on the topic, FSRN's Shannon Young spoke with Steve Horn, a Wisconsin-based research fellow for DSmog blog and a freelance investigative journalist.
You recently wrote an article called Federal Reserve Policy Keeps Fracking Bubble Afloat, and that may change soon. What does the Federal Reserve have to do with fracking, and what changes are on the horizon?
Well, in December 2008, the Federal Reserve pushed forward a policy called quantitative easing, which meant two things that are related but not the same thing. First of all, they set interest rates at close to 0%. It was a record low, and it still is a record low for interest rates for getting a loan. So for financial institutions, private equity, the world that operates in a way that can get those type of loans from the Federal Reserve, they get those loans at a 0% interest rate. It was meant to stimulate the economy at the time. And then also, the policy that the Federal Reserve set was to give junk bonds, meaning bonds that are risky, but if things go well in the investment, then the payoff is nice for the person getting the loan. So both of these policies were used by the oil and gas industry. That's right around the time where things started to pick up for the oil and gas industry with the fracking boom. And so since then, we've seen lots of fields take off, including the Bakken Shale in North Dakota, the Eagle Ford Shale in Texas, the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania. And it's not a coincidence that this happened at the same time, because drilling is extremely expensive. Fracking is a very capital-intensive process. We're talking billions and billions of dollars in capital needed to fulfill the process of fracking. And so, you know, since then we've seen lots of fields boom, but we've also seen lots of fields go sort of bust.
Explain a bit more about the role of junk debt. What is it in plain English, and how does it come into play with regards to fracking?
Well, junk debt is extremely important, not so much for the companies that we think of when we talk about big oil. So it's not as important for an ExxonMobil. It's not as important for a Shell. It's not as important for a Chevron. But this junk debt's extremely important for companies with less capital on hand, smaller companies that may be lesser known, that have been instrumental to unlocking a lot of oil and gas across the United States. And so they're extremely reliant on this junk debt, and it's basically a lifeline. If the policy changes in the Federal Reserve, that means that a lot of these companies go by the wayside. But there's also a concurrent trend happening in the oil and gas industry. Right now there's a lot of discussion about the price of oil. These same companies would be hurt badly if the price of oil drops below $80 per barrel. Say it drops down, right now it's about $80. If it goes down lower per barrel, a lot of these companies would be hurt. So they rely on high prices of oil, and they're extremely reliant on, you know, private capital from private equity firms such as Kohlberg, Kravis and Roberts, Goldman Sachs, you name it, Carlyle Group. So the real issue here is not big oil. Big oil doesn't really come into play for this. In fact, big oil has sold off a lot of its reserves in some of the bigger fields and written those assets off. But we're talking about sort of crisis mode right now for some of the smaller independent companies that have been the real innovators behind the shale gas boom.
Aside from record low interest rates and junk debt, are there any other financial practices that should be of note?
I would just note that it can't be said sort of loudly enough how key the world, you know, Wall Street and the world of private equity, the world of hedge funds has been for the fracking boom. It's not often discussed in the same sentence, but it should. So we're talking about firms like KKR, which own smaller oil and gas companies, and we hear the names of oil and gas companies. We don't often hear about Kohlberg, Kravis and Roberts. We don't often hear about the Carlyle Group. We don't often hear about the Blackstone Group. But all of the money that they've put in to make this drilling possible basically shows that how intertwined the world of Wall Street and private equity is with the world of what we're talking about now, the drilling treadmill, the Federal Reserve, and the like. And that, I mean, if you want to look back historically, you know, the world of private equity and Wall Street is completely intertwined with the creation of the Federal Reserve. And that's a conversation for a different day, but I think that it's definitely research that remains to be done, I think, is important research.
Steve Horn is a research fellow for DeSmog Blog and a freelance investigative journalist. He joined us by phone from Madison, Wisconsin. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
The city of San Francisco has passed an ordinance that regulates Airbnb and other online services that link travelers with people looking to rent space in their homes on a short-term basis. As Max Pringle reports, the city joins a growing list of jurisdictions around the world that are re-examining their laws vis-a-vis the burgeoning sharing economy.
Services like Airbnb allow travelers looking for a short-term rental to connect online with hosts looking to rent out a spare bedroom on a short-term basis. The practice has drawn scrutiny from those who say it violates city zoning and hotel tax laws. San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee says the ordinance gives the sharing economy some much-needed legitimacy and will generate funds for the city.
This is the first effort in the history of this space-sharing movement that we've been able to regulate, and also to make sure that going forward we collect some good revenue for the city as well.
San Francisco Board of Supervisors President David Chu, who authored the legislation, says it was written to make sure home sharers abide by existing city laws and regulations.
Anyone who wants to engage in this will need to register with the city. We'll need to know who you are, and there'll be many requirements around that registration. You'll have to get liability insurance, you'll have to pay your taxes, you'll have to abide by all sorts of life safety rules as well as rent control rules.
San Francisco joins cities like Portland, Oregon, New York, London, and Amsterdam in either recently passing laws regulating home sharing networks or taking a closer look at the issue. Just last year, the California Public Utilities Commission recognized online ride-sharing networks like Uber and Lyft. Other governments have been more wary of the sharing economy. For example, Germany recently passed a nationwide ban of the car-sharing network Uber. A court later overturned that ban. Michelle Grant is research manager for travel and tourism at the global economics consultancy Euromonitor. She says ride-sharing companies have met stiff resistance from the more established transportation industry.
In the case of Uber and Lyft, yeah, certainly it's the taxi commission and taxi companies that have, you know, waged war against those companies because they are direct competitors.
Airbnb says whenever new technologies emerge, they're always met with resistance. A company statement says, quote, "Home sharing is here to stay, and policymakers are looking at old rules, some of which were drafted before the internet even existed, and enacting some common sense regulations for home sharing." But U.S. Senator and former San Francisco Mayor Dianne Feinstein has criticized the new home sharing law. She said it threatens to commercialize neighborhoods zoned as residential. Board of Supervisors member John Avalos says the legislation could mean that precious rental housing could lose out to more lucrative holiday stays.
That could undermine rent control, could undermine the amount of property that's available for renters. Renters are desperately under attack in this city.
Backers of the law say the extra income they get from sharing their homes helps them make ends meet in this notoriously expensive city.
The income makes a huge difference in my retired standard of living.
Nancy Niederhauser is a San Francisco pensioner who uses Airbnb to arrange short-term stays in her home.
It has been a lifesaver this year with medical expenses. It secures my ability to remain in my home and in San Francisco because I am spared depleting my savings so quickly.
But housing rights activists say the law should have required Airbnb to pay $25 million in unpaid back taxes, which accrued prior to the law. Backers of the ordinance say nothing in the law precludes the city from going after back taxes, and it will allow San Francisco to collect millions in tax revenue going forward. Meanwhile, opponents have gathered enough signatures for a ballot initiative that would strengthen laws against holiday rentals in residential neighborhoods and make the registry of Airbnb hosts public. They have until November 23rd to submit their initiative. Max Pringle, FSRN, San Francisco.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. You'll find more of our work, along with information about how you can support it, at fsrn.org. The Republic of Azerbaijan is an oil-rich ex-Soviet nation located in a strategic part of the globe, sandwiched between Russia and Iran. Human rights advocates warn the situation there is deteriorating after a summer of arrests and beatings of prominent activists and independent journalists. A few have been released recently, but many remain jailed, including Dr. Leyla Yunus, who was just nominated for the 2015 Nobel Peace Prize. Now, authorities in Azerbaijan are making it increasingly difficult for NGOs to work in the country. MJ Devalier reports from Baku.
Now that Europe is trying to reduce its dependency on Russian gas, hydrocarbon-rich Azerbaijan is gaining attention. But the ex-Soviet republic has a very poor democratic record. Election observers say that there hasn't been a single transparent election in the country since it gained independence in 1991. In this context, a number of NGOs and think tanks work in the country promoting democratic values. Most are funded by foreign entities, but recently the government amended the law that covers foreign funding for NGOs, adding layers of administrative red tape and placing the groups outside of compliance.
Some government representatives don't understand the role of civil society.
That's Mireli Huseinov, head of the NGO Democracy Learning Public Association.
And sometimes they see NGOs as opposite to them and sometimes as a source of revolution in the country.
During the last few months, human rights activists and pro-democracy organizations have been the target of a large-scale crackdown on civil society. U.S.-based IREX is one of them.
IREX has done a lot of things in Azerbaijan. IREX Education Program Department has sent hundreds of graduate bachelor students to the United States to study and come back and to contribute to the country.
That's Ulviya Asadzadeh. She attended college on IREX scholarships. Until financial constraints forced IREX to close, she worked as a media specialist for the organization.
We trained a lot of citizen journalists. We taught them multimedia, filmmaking, information technology. We brought internet to the remote villages where people did not have any access to the internet.
The organization's office was raided in September and their computers and documents confiscated. Their bank account had been frozen in July. Their staff says that they are under a criminal investigation by the prosecutor's office and they don't know why. The Azeri authorities won't comment on the IREX case specifically, but say that many NGOs were operating in violation of the law. Despite the fact that the country is now chairing the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe, groups like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International and Freedom House roundly criticize Azerbaijan's human rights record. It's within this political climate that IREX used to run development programs on media and education. Asadzadeh says that the concept of media ethics is new in the country.
So you know that Azerbaijan has been a part of the Soviet Union for 70 years, where journalism has been used as a propaganda rather than being a professional source.
IREX is not alone. Transparency International, Oxfam, and the National Democratic Institute have all had their bank account blocked in the past few months. The same thing happened to former Harvard research fellow Leila Aliyeva. Her think tank, the Center for National and International Studies, works on issues like democracy promotion and European integration.
We stopped our activities. We can't legally operate. We have to close our office because we don't have money for rent anymore. We can't go to the meeting, for instance. It's a planned meeting of the researchers from European partner states. And then we can't publish our book.
Aliyeva says that the whole staff is affected. According to Mohamed Gulusadeh, an independent consultant specializing in NGO legislation and a member of the Parliament Monitoring Commission on the impact of the recent amendments on NGOs, a fix is on the way. Gulusadeh says the president has instructed the government to draft new registration rules.
The problem here was that NGOs wouldn't register the grants. When the government realized that there are increasing facts of intentional non-registration of grants, they have introduced a new penalty in the Code of Administrative Offences, which prohibits operations on non-registered grants.
A November 1st deadline for drafts of rewritten rules to easing the registrations on grants has come and gone, and now there is no word on when they are expected. In the meantime, the Azeri Parliament has approved more, even tougher, conditions for foreign NGOs. President Ilham Aliyev is expected to sign these additional rules. Once he does, it will be increasingly difficult for foreign NGOs to operate in Azerbaijan. MJ Del Valle, FSRN, Azerbaijan.
Members of the Sikh community across the world held demonstrations and prayer meetings this week to commemorate the 30th anniversary of the 1984 anti-Sikh riots in India. Thousands of Sikhs were killed in the violence that targeted the community following the assassination of then Prime Minister Indira Gandhi by her two Sikh bodyguards. In New Delhi, hundreds called attention to what they describe as genocide 3 decades ago. Bismillah Gilani has more.
Indian system! Murdabad! Indian system! Murdabad! We want!
Near the parliament building in New Delhi, Sikh protesters chant slogans against the political and judicial system, which has failed to punish the perpetrators of deadly anti-Sikh riots 30 years ago. Most of the protesters are relatives of those killed by marauding mobs in response to Prime Minister Indira Gandhi's assassination in 1984. 45-year-old Manjeet Kaur still has a vivid memory of her father's death.
The two people who killed Indira Gandhi have been punished, but those who killed thousands of Sikhs brutally are still free. My father was dragged out of his vehicle and the attackers put a burning tire around his neck and then hit him with iron rods until he died. What had he done to deserve this?
Indira Gandhi was killed by her two Sikh bodyguards 5 months after she ordered a military operation against the leaders of Sikh separatist movement in the religious minority's holiest shrine, the Golden Temple, in the northern state of Punjab. The military raid killed more than 1,000 people, mostly innocent devotees. In the week-long mob violence following the Prime Minister's murder, the minority Sikh community was targeted in several parts of the country, leaving nearly 4,000 dead. Sikhs blamed some senior leaders of the then-ruling Congress Party for inciting mobs against the community. But almost all of them have been acquitted of the charges by courts, citing lack of evidence against them. Manjinder Singh is General Secretary of the Sikh organization Dal Khalsa.
It was a massacre, genocide, and the judiciary has done nothing in 30 years. How can you get evidence when you drag on the process like this? We are at a stage now where most of the people who had filed cases are no longer alive.
Disappointed with the political system and judiciary, the Sikhs are now turning to international community for help. The protesters today marched to the United Nations office in New Delhi, urging the world body to intervene. Again, Manjinder Singh.
We have gone through all processes and we have explored all avenues, but we haven't gotten justice. And we are convinced that we won't get it here ever. So now we are appealing to the United Nations to take the matter into consideration and form a commission like they did for atrocities against Tamils in Sri Lanka and make India also accountable for the massacre of Sikhs.
In solidarity with the Sikh community, many Tamil and Kashmiri activists also joined Monday's march in New Delhi. More than 20 million Sikhs make up 2% of India's total population, with a section of the community fighting for an independent Khalistan. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
And that does it for this week's program. Today we welcome listeners of WGDR Goddard College Community Radio. FSRN is supported by the radio stations that carry our show and by listeners like you. More information is at fsrn.org. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.